in Racine, 35 in Kenosha. It is 37 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, The Morning Show with Greg Berg, next.
Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for The Morning Show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. The two words MS really strike fear into the hearts of anyone who hears them. We all know that MS stands for multiple sclerosis, and it is one of the most devastating of nervous system disorders, and has caused all kinds of suffering and difficulty in the lives of millions of people. Slowly but surely, advances are being made in understanding what multiple sclerosis is, and perhaps someday a cure can be found. For now, all we can do, and only to a limited extent, is treat the symptoms of multiple sclerosis. One place in the world that is working very, very hard and beginning to achieve some success is the world-renowned Mayo Clinic. And recently, in a study by U.S. News and World Report, Mayo Clinic was actually ranked number one when it comes to exploration of matters of neurology and neurosurgery. And I'm very, very honored to be able to speak for the next few minutes with Dr. Mark Keegan, who is a neurologist, professor of neurology, and chair of the Division of Multiple Sclerosis and Autoimmune Neurology at the Mayo Clinic. He has written a book called Common Pitfalls in Multiple Sclerosis. And I'm very pleased that we can spend a few minutes talking with him about MS, what it is, and what can be done about it for those who are unfortunate enough to contract it. Dr. Mark Keegan, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thanks very much. It's my pleasure to be here.
Glad we can have this conversation. I'm just curious, ahead of us talking about MS, what, if anything in particular, drew you into this particular field of specialty, that is, of neurology? What was it about it that you found most intriguing?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. I was really fascinated by neurology. There's a lot of different aspects to neurology, from the central nervous system, which I concentrate on, which means the brain and spinal cord, as well as all the way down to the peripheral nervous system and the muscle. But I was specifically interested in brain disorders and spinal cord disorders. And when I was looking into what type of subspecialty I wanted to concentrate on, research, I was really attracted to multiple sclerosis. And there's a number of reasons. One of the things is that it was really on the cusp of developing many new medications to relieve symptoms and also the actual inflammation due to multiple sclerosis. And that was really intriguing to me. I was fascinated by it. And I'll have to say that I've been extremely satisfied with that career choice, because we have about 15 FDA-approved medications for relapsing remitting multiple sclerosis right now. And the bulk of those have come on in my time at Mayo Clinic over the last 15 years or so. So it's an exciting time to be researching multiple sclerosis, treating patients with multiple sclerosis, because we have so many good options for them now. It's a very exciting time for ourselves and also our patients.
Hmm. Explain to our listeners what happens in the body when someone has contracted multiple sclerosis. What is going wrong exactly?
Well, we consider multiple sclerosis to be an autoimmune disease of the central nervous system. And what that means is that the body's own immune system that protects us against viruses and other infections starts to attack the myelin sheath, which is really the coating of the nerve in the brain and spinal cord. It's the coating of the nerve. And the blood cells attack that coating for uncertain reasons. But that's what we call an autoimmune disease, and that's what we believe multiple sclerosis is.
What is the function of the myelin? What makes it valuable, what really makes it indispensable for the nerve system, central nervous system, to operate properly? And what occurs then when the myelin is slowly but surely destroyed?
Yeah. The best way to think about the myelin sheath encoding the nerves in the central nervous system is to really think about it as the insulation along a wire, really. And what that does is it protects the nerve, but it also makes the impulses of the nerve from the brain and spinal cord go much faster than it would without that coating. And when that coating is damaged by an immune attack, like in multiple sclerosis, that slows the conduction of the nerves. And in fact, in multiple sclerosis, we also know that some of the nerves themselves are damaged by that immune attack on the myelin sheath as well. So yes, the myelin sheath is damaged with that, but sometimes the wire or the nerve itself can also be damaged. And that slows or halts conduction electrically within the central nervous system, and that's exactly why patients develop weakness or numbness. Now, when there's repair of that myelin sheath, as there is naturally, people regain that function, and we call that the remission. The relapse is the attack and the inflammation. The remission is the repair of that myelin sheath. Now, the problem in multiple sclerosis is even though it is repaired naturally by our body, it doesn't get back to normal, and that's really the key in patients with multiple sclerosis.
Can you explain the term multiple sclerosis? What is there a multiple of, and what is sclerosis? I mean, exactly what does that term refer to? Why is it used to describe this disorder?
Exactly right. Well, multiple, of course, means that there's small spots of inflammation in many different areas of the central nervous system. That includes both small spots within the brain, the optic nerves, which are the eye nerves, the lowest part of the brain called the brain stem, and the spinal cord itself, which is in the neck and mid-back. Sclerosis is sort of an older term when it was first described, and they were looking at autopsy specimens of people that had died with multiple sclerosis. It does seem to be a little bit hardened in those areas, and that's why they call it sclerosis. Under the microscope and on gross anatomy of those areas. And that's where that term sclerosis comes from.
Hmm. My understanding, and this is probably a gross simplification, but I know this from a very dear friend who contracted multiple sclerosis about 20 years ago and unfortunately died several years ago, that there, or at least as how it was explained to him initially, is that there are two very basic kinds of multiple sclerosis, and one is much sort of slower acting, and there's apt to be periods of remission and so on, and then there is another kind of multiple sclerosis that is much more severe, much more acute, where the deterioration is quite relentless and also quicker. Am I characterizing that correctly? And if there are these two kinds of multiple sclerosis, do we understand the distinction between them, why MS can operate in two such different fashions?
Well, actually, when you look at things for multiple sclerosis, if you're going to divide it in two different groups, the best way to divide that would be in relapsing remitting multiple sclerosis and progressive forms of multiple sclerosis. In relapsing remitting multiple sclerosis, you have an acute, meaning over a number of days or weeks, impairment in neurological function that usually stays impaired for a few weeks, but then slowly will get better on its own, again, usually over weeks to months. Sometimes it even gets back to normal. That's the remission, and that's relapsing remitting form of multiple sclerosis. We understand relapsing remitting MS to be inflammatory attacks on the central nervous system with subsequent remission. The second major form of multiple sclerosis is called progressive multiple sclerosis. And if people have had attacks and relapsing remitting MS before, we call that secondary progressive multiple sclerosis. In a small group of patients, about 15% of patients with MS, they've never had a relapsing remitting course before, and they just have progression. We call that primary progressive multiple sclerosis. Now, most people with multiple sclerosis, not everyone, but most, if they accrue disability over time, it's often in the progressive form of multiple sclerosis, and that usually comes many decades after relapsing remitting MS. Not always, but usually. And although people can have impairment due to relapsing remitting MS, they often recover substantially, if not back to normal with those. Now, most of our medications, in fact, essentially all of them are aimed at relapsing remitting MS because they work as anti-inflammatory medications predominantly, we believe. Most of the research now is really focused on halting and reversing progressive multiple sclerosis, because when people do develop that, they do have deterioration over many years and decades that is more insidious.
It seems like one of the mysteries about MS is why this devastating process begins in the first place, why the body's immune system, in a sense, attacks itself, attacks its own body, its own host. Have any strides been made at all in terms of understanding what, if anything, is the trigger? What, if anything, is the cause?
Yeah, many strides have been made into understanding why people develop multiple sclerosis. That being said, we can't tell one individual exactly why they developed MS. But to give you examples, we now know that being very low in vitamin D puts you at greater risk to develop multiple sclerosis. We also feel that lack of exposure to sunlight will increase your risk for multiple sclerosis. It's also clear that people that smoke cigarettes are more likely to develop multiple sclerosis than people that do not. And if people are overweight and obese, especially in women, they may be more likely to develop multiple sclerosis as well. And those are some of the environmental factors that contribute to multiple sclerosis, including in an important association with the Epstein-Barr virus, particularly if people are exposed to that virus in older adolescence or in young adulthood. Most people are exposed to that as children, but that increases the risk of multiple sclerosis. Mm. The other thing that we know is incredibly important is genetic risk. And there are many genes that we know are associated with multiple sclerosis, and one in particular called the HLA gene is one of the more important genes that increases the susceptibility to multiple sclerosis. Hmm. So in fact, it's both genetic and environmental predispositions that make it more likely to develop multiple sclerosis, this autoimmune attack on our central nervous system.
Before we talk about some breakthroughs in treatment that you mentioned early on, let's talk about the fact that there remains no cure for MS. Do you have a sense that any significant progress is being made towards a cure, or is this a hope that is destined to remain out of reach for the foreseeable future?
No, No, I think there is hope that we will develop a cure for multiple sclerosis. My own feeling is it's more likely that we'll develop even better medications for multiple sclerosis that have few side effects. My guess is that's going to occur more likely than a cure for multiple sclerosis. That being said, some people feel that hitting the disease very hard and early can sometimes lead to a change in the immune system that is favorable. That's not exactly a cure yet, but I think what we've found over the last even 10 or 15 years, very rapidly with new knowledge about how multiple sclerosis affects people, what the underlying pathology is, that we can treat it extremely effectively and prevent patients from deteriorating over time many decades down the road. That's the real promise right now.
So help us explain, help us understand how MS was treated before some of these new developments were made. Or really, was there no meaningful treatment for MS, let's say, 20 or 25 years ago? Was this simply something, suffering that people had to endure as best they could? I mean, once upon a time, how was MS treated? And now what are the new developments that make treatment so much more effective?
Yeah, in the past, if somebody had relapsing remitting multiple sclerosis, you would just wait for them to have an attack of multiple sclerosis. And sometimes those patients were treated either with steroids to try to get better faster from that attack, which calms down the inflammation, or with another medication called ACTH, an injection medication that basically calmed down inflammation. In between those attacks, they weren't treated with anything, and they just waited for an attack to come. They were also treated, of course, if they did develop debility, treating them to help with their walking, help with their bladder function, and others that could be affected. Now, the first medication approved for multiple sclerosis was in about 1993, and that was an interferon medication called Betaseron. And it was an injectable medication given every other day. And what that showed is that we could reduce the frequency and severity of attacks of multiple sclerosis if they were treated chronically with that medication, even in between attacks. And that was a big breakthrough in the development of effective treatments for multiple sclerosis.
One of the curious factors of MS is that it can lead to different symptoms in different people. My own friend, for instance, who suffered from MS for many years, towards the end of his life, one of the most difficult symptoms he endured was that his body seemed to lose its ability to regulate its own temperature. That is, at certain points, he would have these attacks where his own body temperature would plunge to terribly low readings, close to, for instance, 90. I mean, the first time this occurred, they didn't have a thermometer in the clinic that could register low enough to register what his body temperature was. It had taken such a precipitous plunge. How often do you see that? Is that a common symptom? It seems like when that occurred to my friend, for the most part, baffling, at least to the local doctors, before he was able to see a specialist about it.
Yeah, you're right. That can happen. It is not common, fortunately, for patients to get hypothermia or low body temperature related to multiple sclerosis. Usually, and this might have been the case in your friend, that's usually after people have developed a lot of debility to multiple sclerosis. That's the most common time where you get this type of hypothermia. We're aware of that symptom, which is uncommon, but we see a lot of patients with multiple sclerosis at Mayo Clinic from the very beginning to the very end of multiple sclerosis. So we are aware of that, and that usually comes from deregulation of temperature from either brainstem or hypothalamic lesions due to multiple sclerosis. And that usually is at more of an end stage of multiple sclerosis than early on. And it is not common, fortunately, this symptom that your friend had.
Right. So if somebody is given this diagnosis, aside from the new treatments that you have mentioned, are there also things that can make a difference for the better in terms of one's own lifestyle choices, for instance? Or do those kind of sort of everyday decisions about how we live not make much of a dent when it comes to something like MS?
No, I think it makes a huge difference. It's very important. Things like I mentioned before, cigarette smoking, it's absolutely critical that people stop cigarette smoking if they have multiple sclerosis. Of course, it's important for their health otherwise. But we do know that patients with multiple sclerosis have a much more difficult and worse disease course if they continue to smoke cigarettes. Another question that I'm given a lot is, what about diet? And we recommend routinely a healthy diet. We don't really recommend standardly that people reduce their diet in one specific area or look at a gluten-free diet or a paleolithic diet. If they're very interested in doing that, that's fine. But we only recommend a healthy diet. And we think it's also very important that people continue with an active exercise program as much as they can do. They should get adequate sleep at night. And that really helps with some of the symptoms that people get with multiple sclerosis, including that of fatigue. If people do have very regular patterns like that with regular exercise, avoiding cigarette smoking, and keeping a healthy diet, that is really crucial for their care in multiple sclerosis.
Dr. Mark Keegan is a neurologist and professor of neurology with the Mayo Clinic. Dr. Keegan, I so appreciate this time that we've been able to share. What do you suggest for people who want still more information about MS?
Well, I think that there are a lot of good websites that give information about MS, but I would recommend mayoclinic.org, as well as the website from the National Multiple Sclerosis Society, which is nmss.org. Those are two sites where you get reliable information about multiple sclerosis. And that is important for our patients and their families to get very reliable information about multiple sclerosis.
Dr. Mark Keegan, thank you so much for your time. Very best wishes to you and your colleagues at the Mayo Clinic.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
The time is 8:33, and part two of WGTD's morning show will be coming up in just a moment. A conversation with writer Anna Lawton about her novel called Amy Story. It's always exciting when we can spend some time exploring an intriguing novel, and particularly when the novel springs from the pen of someone with as rich and varied a life as Anna Lawton. Anna Lawton is originally from Italy, and that experience in and of itself is part of what richly informs her newest book, a novel called Amy's Story. She has actually extensively studied Russian literature, and she has taught courses about culture and literature and cinema at both Georgetown University and Purdue University. She actually worked for the American Embassy in Moscow for a time. She recently co-founded a new publishing house, New Academy, Academia Publishing, and has written several highly acclaimed scholarly books, edited all kinds of essays and articles, and now a novel called Amy's Story that is set in multiple time periods and in multiple ways involves the experience of those who find themselves, in a sense, in a new place as immigrants. And, of course, there is no central topic that could be more timely. And we have Anna Lawton on the phone for the next few minutes to talk about this novel and why she put it together the way she did, and we'll be exploring all kinds of different things. Anna Lawton, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
I'm glad to be talking to you. It appears that at least most of the writing that you have done through your career has been not so much in the realm of fiction. You've done a lot of scholarly work, books and essays and articles and so on, and now we're talking about a work of fiction. Can you explain what, if anything, fueled your transition into fiction? What, in a sense, what hunger was it satisfying?
Okay. Well, first of all, let me say that there is a big difference between these two modes of writing, because scholarly writing is, well, it requires rigorous research and also a constrictive scheme, while fiction allows for free flow of ideas and, you know, a good deal of imagination, although it also requires some organizing design and strict discipline. But in my last scholarly book on Russian cinema, I inserted a few fictional vignettes, and this was a very unorthodox thing to do, and I thought it would stir a wave of disapproval in the academic community. Instead, the book won a prestigious award, and more importantly, it made me realize that I could write fiction, and that this was what I wanted to do.
Did anything in particular prompt you to insert those bits of fiction into what otherwise was a nonfiction book? I mean, what was behind that choice?
Well, the book was about cinema. So, in a sense, about a narrative mode of expression, and so I followed in that vein. And while writing criticism or even my observations of the Russian reality in those days, I had other visions that came out of my imagination, and so I wrote a few little stories that I inserted in the book.
By the way, this is a tangential question, so I don't want to spend too much time on it, but I'm just curious how you came to be so interested in Russian cinema. Did anything in particular prompt you to pursue that study?
Well, I have a PhD in Russian literature, not cinema. But then I found let's say, similarity between the two media, in the sense that both tell a story, although cinema tells a story in images and literature uses words. So there is a difference in the way the brain perceives these two means of expression. But I made the transition, you know, from literature to cinema, and I found it extremely interesting and enticing.
So this novel that you have written called Amy's story involves, at least to a large extent, the experience of people who, in one way or another, have experienced transplantation from one country and from one culture to another. And, of course, this is, at least to some extent, a reflection of something you yourself have experienced. Is that the main thing that inspired you to write this novel, trying to tell that kind of story?
Probably that came second. Well, since this is a novel, it is, first of all, a great love story. And it is also a story of immigration, and it only unfolds on the background of America's history of the past 40 years. There are also flashbacks to an Italian setting, an 18th century villa in one of Italy's Italy's winemaking regions. However, this is a contemporary story, and the novel takes a realistic look at our society today and attempts to make sense of the problems we're facing. Among these is the problem of immigration. So if you want me to elaborate a little bit of my experience as an immigrant, I can do that.
Yes, I wish you would. And, of course, we're talking about the fact that you have lived here for more than four decades. Yeah. And so you have experienced a lot. And not only that, you have probably witnessed some really intriguing changes here in America over that time.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, my story as an immigrant is not very typical, because I came to the U.S. as the result of a romance with a young American who later became my husband. And we were both students at the time. So I came to the U.S. not by necessity, but by choice. Actually, my family was quite well off, and I grew up in a comfortable middle-class environment, surrounded by art in all its forms. But I can sympathize with the difficulties other immigrants encounter, because even if I, you know, I was not in a disadvantaged condition at the beginning, it was not easy. The worst challenge was a sense of displacement. My English was adequate, but far from perfect, and I cannot say that I ever encountered discrimination, but I was certainly perceived as a foreigner, and so I felt I didn't belong, and that that of course was nobody's fault. It was a fact, but I did my best to assimilate. And in the end, I succeeded. Now I feel as comfortable here as I do in Italy. I go back and visit often, at least twice a year. And Italy has remained, you know, my childhood home, a place to visit when I feel like being pampered, so to speak, and having fun. But America is my home as an adult. Where I can live my life and strive to realize my full potential.
We're speaking with Anna Lawton, and we are talking about the novel that she has just published called Amy's Story. Explain to our listeners who Amy is and what relationship she bears to who you are.
Brings up the question of autobiography, and this is a question I get very often. But I must say no. Now this novel is fiction; it's not autobiographic. Well, Amy bears some resemblance to you know, Amy's story bears some resemblance to specific periods in my life. And this is inevitable because a good novel is the expression of the author's personality. So Amy was born in Italy, Italian mother, but an American father. And then she moved to the States to be near her father. She eventually inherited the publishing house that the father owned. So in that capacity, she is editing a manuscript by a childhood friend, Stella. And Stella's story is very important in the context of the novel. It is the central part of the narrative. The novel is framed. It has a frame that begins and ends in the present, but the central part unfolds in the past.
Right.
And that is the Stella story.
Right. So our listeners understand, we actually begin the relatively brief first part of the story of the novel is actually set in the year 2001,
yes.
as Amy takes in hand this manuscript by her friend Stella, and part two of the book, which is by far the longest portion of the book, we follow through Stella's story manuscript, the years 1967 to 1985, and then part three brings us back to the present once again. So
yes.
What prompted you to construct your novel in that kind of fashion? I mean, writing a full-length novel is, in a sense, challenging enough without, in a sense, creating such a complex framework. What made you want to construct the novel in this way? What did it make possible?
Uh-huh. Well, you know, there are many techniques an author can choose to structure her work. And the simplest one is to begin from the beginning and to proceed from, A to Z chronologically. But this is not so interesting anymore because about a century ago, because of a new awareness of the space-time relation, modernist writers began to structure their novels in a rather messy, quote-unquote, way. That made it more difficult for the reader to navigate the text, but also it afforded the reader more freedom of interpretation. My novel is structured in that way that you described. The frame gives the dynamism to the narrative, and also it generates curiosity in the reader that feels compelled to keep reading in order to discover in which way the beginning connects to the end. So it's a trick.
Interesting. There's also at least one portion of the novel in which what we see on the page actually looks more like a script with the names of characters followed by a colon, followed by what they speak, as though we are reading the script of a play or maybe a screenplay. Is that there for any particular reason, and does it have anything to do with, for instance, the study you've done of film?
Well, obviously it does. Probably that influenced my writing style. My narrative can easily be adapted to a screenplay because I definitely favor action, dialogue, and atmosphere over, long monologues and inner reflections. And in my novels, both of them, this is the second one, there are also direct references to film. Here, for example, the character of Jim He's a film teacher and filmmaker, and this character underlines the significance of that medium as an art form and also as an educational tool. But as I said before, film and literature remain a very distinct communication systems that have a different kind of impact on the brain. Studies in cognitive psychology have demonstrated it.
As I read through your intriguing novel, one line that really stands out for me that I wanted to be sure to ask you about was something that is sort of thought about by your character of Amy, when mm-hmm. she remembers being asked at certain points in time, "Where are you from?" And yes. that often when she would answer that she was born elsewhere, born in Italy, that she would feel like the person who asked the question was then looking at her as though she had a disability, as though she somehow needed extra help. I wonder if this is something that is a reflection of something you yourself have felt as an immigrant to the United States. And of course, you're describing a scenario in which that does not imply unkindness or lack of welcome, but nevertheless might be something that you would wish people would not be thinking when they meet you and understand where you're from. Can you talk a moment about that?
Oh, sure. Actually, the quote from the book that you used does not refer to Amy, but to another character who is a part of a family of very poor immigrants.
Oh, that's Rosa?
Rosa.
Ah.
Yes. And I guess that the feeling is more appropriate for the typical immigrant, Italian immigrant, that had to struggle, you know, at the beginning of the 20th century in New York and so on and so forth. But I perceive this kind of attitude toward myself to a much lesser degree, as I said, a sense of being perceived as a foreigner, which I was. So it was not anything offensive. It was something a little bit annoying, but definitely not offensive. And people have the best intentions when they ask, "Where are you from?" They're motivated by curiosity and interest. And so I treated it this way as if people were really interested in me. And I capitalized on that.
Sure. But I think you really are touching on something very, very important. I want to read this brief little portion. So this, again, is talking about when people are asked where they are from, because from their speech it's mm-hmm. it's clear that they are not from here.
Right.
You write, "This branded them inexorably as not quite American, even in the eyes of the best-intentioned people, and triggered the dreaded question, 'Where are you from?' at each and every first casual encounter. On occasion, they were met with hostility. More often, it was a sympathetic but overly concerned state that made them feel diminished, as if the person had just learned that they suffered from some disability and needed help." I think that is so intriguing, that idea of feeling diminished in the mm-hmm. country where one lives. And it's probably good for all of us to think about the ways in which we might inadvertently cause somebody else to feel in any way diminished.
Well, yes, but it's as I said, there is no ill intention most of the time. And it's just the fact that the immigrant has to accept, you know, even though it may be annoying.
Is this
I don't know what else to say.
Right.
I think that anything that can raise awareness of these problems, especially nowadays, is very timely. And therefore, the book is very timely because, it presents different kinds of immigration. One is the story of this family, Rosa's family, typical, a story that we have heard and seen in the movies so many times. Then there's the story of Amy and Stella that come here as privileged people. And then there's also a little episode of a Russian intellectual that comes to the U.S. because of, let's say, persecution in the Soviet Union, not the new Russia. So he tells about his story in the Soviet Union, the suppression of civil liberties, of freedom of speech, and then finally his expulsion from the country.
Mm. There are...
All different experiences.
Yes. All woven together quite expertly in this novel called Amy's Story, published by New Academia Publishing, and the author, Anna Lawton. Anna Lawton, do you plan to write more fiction after this?
Oh, definitely. Yes, because I enjoy it so much, you know. Once you start, you cannot stop.
Well,
although it's really serious and hard work, but there is so much elation and such a surge of energy when you write, and surprises, because before I can write a page, I have to hear the characters' voices in my mind. If I don't hear the characters speak, I cannot write. And sometimes they really take the lead and guide me through the development of the story. And the story takes some turns and twists unexpectedly that I never thought of. And it surprises myself. You know, I think, this is how it goes.
The novel, again, is called Amy's Story and published by New Academia Press. And Anna Lawton, I congratulate you on this intriguing novel and wish you well with all of your future writing. And I thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show. This was fun.
Thank you so much, Greg. It was a pleasure.
Monday on The Morning Show, you'll hear my interview with New York Times reporter Gina Calata, the author of Mercies in Disguise, a story of hope, a family's genetic destiny, and the science that rescued them. The book focuses on the true story of a family in North Carolina that is devastated by some sort of inherited disease, a mysterious disease that causes all kinds of terrible suffering. The story is about their resolve in the face of this this ordeal, and also the tireless effort of scientists to unlock the mystery. On Tuesday, renowned choral composer Jake Runnestad will be joining me in the studio. He will be visiting Carthage College next week. Wednesday, novelist Julia Dahl. Thursday, the mayor of Racine, soon to be leaving his post, John Dickert, live in our studios along with Nan Calvert. The morning show airs every weekday morning.